This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And happy Friday, everyone, which means it's time now for our Week in Review.
I was at the Olympics running the games. That was the job I had. And therefore, I was not running Bain Capital and therefore not responsible for the actions of Bain Capital when I left.
That was Mitt Romney back in 2002. But this week, a Boston Globe article examines federal documents that suggest Romney remained involved with Bain for longer than he says.
Also this week, while Senate candidate Elizabeth Warren was fighting off attacks about her claims of Native American heritage, the campaign dollars were rolling in.
It appears to have spurred her fundraising efforts, and I think some of this is a response to what Democrats perceive as a smear against her.
Meanwhile, Boston School Superintendent Carol Johnson came under fire for allowing a principal to continue working after he was arrested for domestic violence.
I made a mistake. I wish I had done things very differently. In retrospect, I should have placed Dr. Peterson on leave immediately until his case was resolved and then determined his continued employment.
And State Representative Carlos Enriquez of Dorchester arrested this week for alleged domestic violence.
I was assaulted like many others, but my situation has been thrust to the public eye because of the status of my attacker.
Those are just some of the week's top stories we're going to consider right now. And joining us now to talk about them is WBUR's David Boeri. Hey, David, great to see you in here.
Hi, Anthony.
Also with us is Gin Dumptious, news editor at the Dorchester Reporter. And Gin, welcome back to Radio Boston. Great to see you here.
Thanks for having me.
So let's begin with presidential politics and this question. Does it matter when Mitt Romney left Bain Capital? It matters a lot to President Obama's reelection campaign, which has accused Romney of lying after the Boston Globe reported this week that government documents listed him as in charge of the private equity firm 3 years longer than he previously stated. Here's Obama campaign senior advisor Stephanie Cutter.
Either Mitt Romney, through his own words and his own signature, was misrepresenting his position at Bain to the SEC, which is a felony, or he was misrepresenting his position at Bain to the American people to avoid responsibility for some of the consequences of his investment.
The Romney campaign calls those statements reckless and asked the Boston Globe to print a retraction, which it declined to do. At issue now are documents filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission that list various Bain-run companies as owned by Mitt Romney after he left the private equity firm to run the Salt Lake City Olympics in February 1999. David, let's start with you. It's a complicated story. What's your take on this story?
Is it ever?
But and it's been hashed over a number of times for quite a while. What do you see
today?
Well,
look, the first line of Romney's life story is that he ran Bain Capital. That was his campaign for office from the minute he set foot into public campaigning back in the 90s, that we need a successful businessman to run the economy. So it makes sense that all along the line, when there have been close races, people look at Bain Capital and what he did, what he didn't do, what they did, whether he was running it or not, and it gets you in the weeds pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. I have to say, I've just been looking at Schedule 13Ds with the SECs, and I've been reading about investments in some manufacturing company making toasters in Guangdong, China. I mean, this is really in the weeds. The question is whether he withstands this whole onslaught about Bain. And it is an onslaught, and it's not going to go down to one particular point, whether he was or wasn't running it, or whether he was and wasn't there and the sole owner at the time. But it comes back to a theme that we have this week, I think, that it's going to be parallel to these different characters we're looking at, which is, how much goodwill is there toward Mitt Romney? And will people jump at this and say, you know, he's okay. I tend to believe him in his account here. Well, the problem with Romney is a lot of people aren't particularly fond of him, and they do see him as a plutocrat. And so the question is whether this stuff sticks in totality, not the particular details, it seems to me.
If it adds to a sort of narrative about this money. Again, what's your take about this story?
I believe, it's one of those things where I agree with David. Romney's whole biography is part of being a businessman. And what the Obama campaign has done is tried to turn that into a weakness by focusing on Bain Capital. And in terms of Politico said this today, it really doesn't matter what the facts are at a certain point, because voters will just be absorbing the negative aspects of Romney's life story there at Bain, and the Romney campaign is apparently not doing a very good job of rebutting those.
Well, the Boston Globe ran the story on page one yesterday. It should be pointed out that others who have looked into it came to a different conclusion. Among them, for example, factcheck.org, which concluded that all kinds of official Bain documents listed Romney as the owner after 1999, but none of them actually contradicted this basic claim that he wasn't running them. And the point here is that, you know, as Romney departed quickly for the Winter Olympics, it took a while to wind down and reorganize all these entities. So, of course, his name remained on certain documents, but the basic claim of the campaign was he wasn't running Bain or these companies. There's no evidence that, in fact, he was, other than his name shows up on these documents.
Well, he's the 100% owner, and he's the 100% owner of the company for 3 years after he left. But does that mean he's running it? Well, maybe not. But, you know, you're going to knock this one down, and even today I'm reading other ones about more job outsourcing. Now we're reading about Bermuda and what was going on in Bermuda. Why won't he answer this question? Why won't he answer that question? What about his wife? What about these secret funds that were made secret by from American voters in the political system by putting them into Bermuda? It's knock one down, another one pops up, and they're for Romney's disadvantage here. They're all popping up seemingly together.
And again, it does sort of seem like there is this narrative that Romney needs to answer about his wealth. He's only released one tax return. There are questions about blind trusts, offshore tax shelters, Swiss bank accounts, all of which could be answered if he released more of his tax returns. But anyway, these questions remain, and this story seems to sort of add to that narrative.
Exactly. And it's also something that the Romney campaign must have been expecting because it came up in the Republican primary. So again, it just comes back to, you know, them obviously not having an effective way to push back on this, or at least there's some sort of internally in the campaign they're having trouble wrapping their hands around this.
Well, let's move on to the case of Boston School Superintendent Carol Johnson, who spent a lot of time this week apologizing. The story: Johnson allowed headmaster Rodney Peterson to remain in his job after he was arrested for domestic violence. Peterson allegedly punched and choked his wife. He admitted to sufficient facts for a jury to find him guilty. Johnson then wrote a glowing reference to the judge who sentenced him. And the story came out this week that Carol Johnson spent a lot of time admitting that what she now sees as her errors. Here's what she told WBUR.
I made a mistake. I wish I had done things very differently. In retrospect, I should have placed Dr. Peterson on leave immediately until his case was resolved and then determined his continued employment. I made a judgment call, but in retrospect, that judgment call sent a mixed message to our students and also to some of our families.
Not good enough to some of her critics. Here's City Councilor John Connolly, who chairs the council's education committee, and said that it's time for Johnson to step down.
I appreciate the apology overall, but I don't think it's okay to simply say I'm sorry and I've put a policy in place so this won't happen again. This is the sort of thing that doesn't require a policy. You know what the right thing to do here is, and you just either you do it or you don't. It wasn't done here. Do we really need to be told by words on a piece of paper that it's not okay to put a batterer back in charge of a school where he's going to be responsible for overseeing hundreds of children every day?
Again, clearly Carol Johnson could have handled this situation differently. Well, what's your take on the story?
Well, I think, given how she reacted after the Globe story, she went to the Globe, she went on BUR and also on Jim Browdy's show to apologize, you know, basically spending a good 48 hours just to straight out apologizing. I think, you know, at the end of the day, she's going to survive. She's got the support of Mayor Thomas Menino, the chair of the school committee, Reverend Groover. I think this does leave little room for future errors, but she will survive.
David, Johnson made, her backers point to significant accomplishments. They say things like she's helped boost graduation rates, test scores, lowered the dropout rate, and the waiting list for schools have gotten longer, an indication that more families are choosing Boston Public Schools. Can she ride this out?
She can and will ride this out for the same point I was making earlier. Unlike Romney, who has problems with a large section of the population, there's this tremendous goodwill toward Carol Johnson in the city. Nobody denies her commitment or total commitment to the students of the Boston school system. And, you know, her behavior, that's not to say that she's performed well at times, and her behavior here is absolutely mystifying. But I mean, Jim Browdy, the TV talk show host, at one point compared her to Bernie Law, which is just laughable. I mean, she is no cardinal law here in what she did. It's absolutely mystifying. But after having said that and having said that she should resign, or if not resign, be fired, she called him up, was on the show, and again, just made it clear that she had made mistakes, sent bad messages. Once again, she loves to talk in terms of setting examples for Boston school students, and she said, we sent the wrong message. Always we need to err on the side of the Boston school community, of protecting the community and of our kids, and sending the message that violence will not be tolerated. Unfortunately, what's sad here is that didn't happen in this particular case.
I was impressed. I mean, without sort of weighing in on whether or not she should step down, I was impressed that here's a public official who goofed and said, yeah, I goofed. I don't know. You don't hear that a lot.
That's a fairly rare occurrence there. And you know, again, that speaks to kind of the how seriously they were taking the charges at the school department, and how much they wanted to push back on it.
Well, let's move on to another story involving disturbing allegations of domestic violence. Dorchester State Rep Carlos Henriquez was arrested on charges of domestic assault and battery and domestic kidnapping. 23-year-old Catherine Gonzalez told police that Henriquez punched and tried to choke her during an altercation as they were driving in Boston earlier this week. Henriquez denied the charges. On Wednesday, Gonzalez came forward with this statement.
My credibility has been questioned, and my private life has become topic of speculation. Why? Because the man I was dating hit me, and he's a public figure. I was assaulted like many others. But my situation has been thrust to the public eye because of the status of my attacker.
Now, State Representative Henriquez has pleaded not guilty. In a statement, he called the charges completely untrue. Again, you've covered Henriquez over the years. Tell us something about him.
Well, he's considered a pretty laid-back guy, and before this incident, he was considered a rising star. Now, I think most people expect him, if he stays in the House, it's going to be a speaker or two before he rises into leadership. But I think most people, the people you talk to in the neighborhood are pretty shocked, but they're also frustrated and disappointed, because if you look at his story, even looking at it in the best possible light, it's bad judgment to be out there at 2 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the morning. So, you know, there's a lot of frustration in the district about how he got himself there.
Yeah, well, we do not know. This is a he said, she said mm-hmm. story, although it's clear that the bruises and scrapes are certainly presumptive evidence that something wrong took place. But it needs to be said that Carlos Tony Henriquez has a very good reputation, somebody who's serious, motivated. He was a youth worker. He had a job as a manager at Kinko's, and he had so many people coming in looking for jobs that he took it on himself to help people find jobs. And this is one of his big commitments. And, you know, the criticism of him coming from the community, if any, during this last year or so, is that he's too quiet on Capitol Hill because it's seen that he's been studying so hard as to how to be a good state rep. So certainly this is a very unfortunate situation for him. And it goes back once again to this theme. How much do you know him? How much goodwill is there? Well, he's starting out. He's not particularly well known. He's not at all known outside the district. I went on to Google last night. The first 24 pages of Google involving Carlos Henriquez were all about assault, battery, and kidnapping.
Mm. Well, this week, House Speaker Bob DeLeo declined to talk about any possible sanctions. He called the allegations disturbing and troubling and said the matter is now being handled by appropriate authorities and the process needs to play itself out. That's probably the best that can be said about this sad story at this point. Well, let's continue with politics and a story about following the money. Between April and June, the second quarter of this year, Democratic Senate candidate Elizabeth Warren raised more than $8.6 million, a stunning sum, evidence that the Senate race is attracting all kinds of dough from inside and outside the state. The incumbent senator, Republican Scott Brown, didn't do too badly during the same period, taking in about $5 million. Big money that's making the race for the Senate in Massachusetts one of the costliest, if not the costliest, in the nation. David Boeri, what do you make of all this cash?
We are on a trajectory to out-Texas Texas this year. This is unbelievable. Check the numbers. Warren's raised $24 million since last year. Mm. Brown's raised $12 million, but he has another $6 million left over from 2010. So that is $42 million right there. We got 4 months to go. We haven't seen this kind of money flying around since TARP. And if you figure out that there are 4 million registered voters in Massachusetts, so far both candidates have raised $10 per registered voter. And we got 4 months left. So Texas, move over.
Again, what do you make? I mean, I guess one thing we can be sure that this means is we're going to see a lot of TV advertising, and there's probably going to be a new generation of slick political consultants on both sides gainfully employed. That's what I take away from this at this point.
Well, it's also a good time to start a TV station or a radio station because you're just going to be rolling in ad money. I think the fundraising shows that they're – you know, here are two juggernauts slugging it out. I know their supporters each try to portray their guy or in Warren's case, a woman as the underdog. And that's just not the case. I mean, it's going to be one of the biggest, it already is one of the biggest races in the country. I believe the Clinton Senate race was the one that drew the most money. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if we're going to surpass that, but we're definitely going to come close.
We're already in the stage, Anthony, it's reminiscent of talking about nuclear proliferation, where the question is, at this point with these TV ads, how many times do you want the rubble to bounce? I mean, you know, we got 42 yeah. million. Just think if both candidates took half of what they've raised and put it into a summer jobs program for teenagers, they could actually hire kids and go out with brochures from both campaigns door to door. But add to all this the fact that the Republicans and Democrats this year are going to indulge New Hampshire's ongoing fantasy that it's a kingmaker. And that means we're going to have all that money for New Hampshire into Boston TV stations. So we got that plus the $40 million so far from the two campaigns here. And so we are talking about MIRV'd missiles, and we're going to have voters screaming for surrender because this is going to be carpet bombing.
Well, I think you're talking about a problem with the overall national finance, campaign finance system that someone someday soon has got to take care of, but that seems a little ways off. There's more to talk about here, but I want to leave time for our hubbub, so let's move on to that story that didn't quite make it above the fold this week, and let me start with you, Magna.
Actually, I want to save mine for last today.
We're going to come back to Magna. Again, let me come over to you and ask you for your hubbub.
Sure. Well, this one definitely flew under the radar in Dorchester because of the what happened with Rep. Henriquez. But there was a block party on Wendover Street. It was it's an area that's kind of plagued with a lot of trouble. And it was a block party that went off very well. You know, there were no known police incidents or people arrested. But it was very, very well put together. And everybody went home pretty happy, from what I can tell.
Glad to hear that, David. How about you?
This just in: a state of emergency has been declared on Plum Island, where million-dollar homes are in danger of falling into the sea. And breathless television reporters are explaining that this just in: now breaking, erosion is threatening the beach. Hello, erosion. It's a story that's only about 10,000 years old, going back to the Ice Age. Why do you think we have Plum Island and Cape Cod in the first place? Erosion. Erosion makes beaches. Erosion takes beaches away and takes the sand and makes new beaches somewhere else. So now that we're hearing about the heartache of losing million-dollar homes that were built on sand, old-timers built shacks on the beach, and they built their real homes away from the beach. I love Plum Island, don't get me wrong. It has the best clams on the backwaters in Massachusetts, but it's geology. And erosion is the one acceptable form of income redistribution we have left in this country, where people who live on Third Avenue can hope that someday, for a short period of time perhaps, they'll have beachfront property.
Or the folks in Nevada, for example.
So really, so you know, when reporters fret about erosion destroying million-dollar homes, I worry about the erosion in the public treasury.
All right. David Boeri, WBUR's very own. Thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Have a great weekend. And Gin Dumptious, news editor of the Dorchester Reporter, thank you for joining us. Have a great weekend as well.
You too. Thanks.
Okay, so can I sneak my hubbub in
yes,
here now?
Yes, now we're going to come
because my hubbub actually just surreptitiously did sneak in here. It's an actual person, our own producer and reporter and fill-in host, Adam Ragusea. Sigh.
Hello.
Because he's, hey Adam, because he's doing the unthinkable. He's actually leaving us at Radio Boston. Oh. Adam, how dare you?
I know, I'm a bad, bad person.
Terribly bad. But seriously, no, you're on to some pretty amazing things.
I'm very excited. I'm going down to Georgia Public Broadcasting, believe it or not, where I'm going to help start up a thing called the Center for Collaborative Journalism at Mercer University. Basically, the Knight Foundation gave us a bunch of millions of dollars to figure out a new way to save local journalism and possibly democracy itself. So I'll let you know how that goes.
That is so like you. Your goals are never small. I love that. But Adam did start at WBUR around this time in 2008. He helped cover the 2008 presidential conventions. And, of course, he's been a fixture here at Radio Boston, covering lots of issues important to the city, taxis, those fake crosswalk buttons.
I know.
The first daily edition of Radio Boston.
Those real food trucks, let's not forget
that's
them.
That's right. He introduced me to Clover, thank goodness. and of course, one that I particularly loved, you live long and prosper, Adam. You interviewed Leonard Nimoy.
It was one of the best days of my life. I got to say, this show is so good and has gotten so much better with the support of our listeners. And frankly, the fact that it's not the boring hole in the middle of WBUR's schedule every day is a testament to how vibrant and exciting a place this town is, and that is a testament to us all.
Alas, Adam, you'll be leaving a hole here, though, when
it's
you
true.
Depart.
Adam, we wish
Cheers.
You well. It's been
Cheers,
a pleasure
Adam.
Working with you. Good luck. Thanks a lot.
Good night and good luck.
That's Adam Ragusea on his last day here at Radio Boston, but we will continue to broadcast nonetheless, because up next, Kevin Bleier, Emmy Award-winning writer for The Daily Show on rewriting the Constitution of the United States. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Stay with us.